After that great burst of sound, the silence was daunting. But Lobengula paced slowly along the ranks, and in his eyes was the terrible sorrow of a father for the sons who must die. This was the hour which he had dreaded from the first day he took the little redwood spear in his right hand. This was the destiny which he had tried to avoid, and now it had overtaken him. His voice boomed, and he lifted the spear and pointed to the east. "The enemy that comes upon us now is like," the spear shook in his hand, "like the leopard in the goat kraal, like the white termites in the king post of a hut. They will not stop until all is destroyed." The massed regiments of Matabele growled, straining like hunting dogs against the leash, and Lobengula stopped in the centre of their lines and threw the leopard-skin cloak back from his right arm. He turned slowly until he faced into the east, where Jamison's columns were massing far over the horizon. And his spear arm went back to its full stretch. He stood poised in the classic stance of the javelin thrower. And there was a soft susurration in the air as 10,000 lungs filled with breath and held it. Then, with a heart-stopping shout, the cry of a man crushed under the iron wheel of his own destiny, Lobengula hurled the war spear into the east, and his shout was echoed by 10,000 throats. "Gee! Gee!" they roared and stabbed in the air with the broad silver blades, stabbing at the still invisible enemy. Then the impis formed one behind the other. Led by their indunas, their matched shields overlapping, they swept past the king, fierce in their pride, leaping high and flashing their assegais, and Lobengula saluted them. The Imbezu and the Inyati, the Ingubu and the Inzumvukuzani, the moles that burrow under a mountain, with their mat-red shields held high, and Butso the axe prancing at their head. They wound away into the eastern grasslands, and Lobengula could still hear their singing faintly on the heated air long after the last of them had disappeared from view. A little group of indunas and guards still attended the king, but they waited below at the gate of the stockade. Lobengula was alone upon the deserted hillside. All the dignity and regal pride had gone out of his bearing. His grossly swollen body slumped like that of a very old and sick man. His eyes were rheumy with unshed tears, and he stared out into the east, without moving, listening to the fading war chants. At last he sighed, shook himself, and hobbled forward on his crippled, distorted feet. Painfully he stooped to retrieve the little redwood spear, but he paused before his fingers touched it. The blade of the spear of kingship had snapped through. He picked up the broken pieces and held them in his hands, and then he turned and shuffled slowly down from the hills of the indunas. The company flag stood high above the laager on a slightly crooked pole of mapani. It had hung limply in the stupefying heat all that morning, but now as the patrol rode in across the open ground above the river bank, it unfurled briefly on a random current of air, snapped as though to draw attention to itself, and then extended its full glory for a moment before sagging wearily once again. At the head of the patrol, Ralph Ballantyne turned to his father, who rode at his side. "That flag makes no bones about it, Papa." The pretty crosses of St. George, St. Andrew, and St. Patrick that made up the Union Jack had the company insignia superimposed upon them, the lion guardant with a tusk of ivory held in its claw and the letters under it BSAC, British South Africa Company. "Servants of the company first, and of the Queen a good deal later." "You're a cynical rascal, Ralph." Zuga could hardly suppress his smile. "Are you suggesting that there is a man in all our company here for personal gain rather than glory of empire?"
"Perish the thought," this time Ralph chuckled.
"By the way, Papa, how many land grants have you bought up so far?"
"I'm losing count. Is it 30 or 35?
"This is a dream I've worked for all my life, Ralph. It's coming true before our eyes. And when it does, I'll have my fair reward, and nothing more. The lager was drawn up in its rigid square 300 yards from the steep banks of the Shangani River, in the centre of a dried-out clay pan. The surface was as flat and bare as a tennis court. The clay had cracked into irregular briquettes that curled up at the edges. They crunched under the horses' hooves as Zuga led the patrol in. They had been out for 2 days, scouting the road beyond the river, and Zuga was pleased to see that during his absence, St. John had taken Zuga's advice and had his axemen hack down the brush around the edges of the pan to open the field of fire. Now any attacker would have to cross 300 yards of bare clay to reach the square of wagons, all of it under the evil little cyclopean scrutiny of the Maxim guns. As they cantered up, a party unchained the wheels of one of the wagons and dragged it aside to allow them to enter, and a sergeant in company uniform saluted Zuga as he passed and called after him. "General St. John's compliments, sir, and will you report to him directly?" "My bet is that you need a drink." Mungo St. John took one look at the dust that clung like flour in Zuga's beard and the dark patches of sweat that had soaked through his shirt. Coldly, Zuga nodded his thanks and poured from the bottle that held down one corner of the map. "The impis are out in full array," he said, and let the whiskey soak the cloying dust from the back of his throat before going on. "I have identified most of them. There's Gandang's in Yati and Manonda's in Sukamini." He reeled off the names of the Indunas and their impis, glancing at the notes he had made on his pad. "We had a brush with the moles and had to shoot our way out and ride for it, but still we reached the Bembezi River before turning back." "Where are the impis, Ballantyne? Damn it, man, we've advanced 70 miles from Iron Mine Hill and seen neither hide nor hair of them," Jamieson demanded almost petulantly. "They are all around us, Doctor. 1,000 or more in the trees just across the river, and I cut tracks that showed that 2 more impis had circled out behind us. They are probably lying across the Longiwe Hills, watching every move we make." "We must bring them to battle," Jamieson fretted. "Every day the campaign lasts is costing the shareholders money." "Well, they won't attack us here, not while we're in a lager, not across open ground." "Where, then?" "Well, they will attack in the Zulu way, in broken ground or thick bush. I have marked 4 likely defiles ahead of us, places where they'll be able to creep up close on either side or lay to ambush the wagons as we pass." "You want us to walk into their trap rather than draw them out?" Mungo asked. "You will not draw them out. I think their commander here is Gandang, the king's half-brother. He's far too cunning to come at us in the open. If you want to fight them, it must be in the bad ground." "When this serpent is coiled with his head drawn back and his mouth agape to show the venom hanging like drops of dew upon his fangs, then the wise man does not stretch out his hands towards him." Gandang spoke softly, and the other Indunas cocked their heads to listen to his words. "The wise man waits until the serpent uncoils and begins to creep away. Then he steps upon the head and crushes it. We must wait. We must wait to take them in the forests, when their wagons are strung out, and the outriders cannot see one another. Then we cut the column into pieces and swallow each one, a mouthful at a time." "Yet my young men are tired of waiting," said Manonda, facing Gandang across the fire. Manonda was the commander of the elite in Sukamini Impe, and though there was silver on his head, there was still fire in his heart. They all knew him to be brave to the edge of folly, quick to take an insult, and quicker still to revenge it. "These white barbarians have marched unopposed across our lands, while we trail around them like timid girls guarding our maidenheads and giggling behind our hands. My young men grow weary of waiting, Gandang, and I with them." "There is time for timidity, Manonda, my cousin, and there is a time to be brave." "The time to be brave is when your enemy stands brazenly before you. There are 600. You have counted them yourself, Gandang, and we are 6,000. Manonda grinned mockingly around the circle of listening men. On the brow of each was the headring of high office, and on their arms and legs the tassels of courage. Shame on those that hesitate, said Manonda the Bold. Shame on you, Batso. Shame on you, Ntabeni. Shame on you, Gambo. His voice was filled with scorn, and as he said each of their names, they hissed with angry denial. Then there was the sound from beyond the circle of squatting in dunas, a sound in the night that chilled and silenced all. It was the eerie wail of mourning for the dead, and as they listened it came closer, and with it were many other voices. Gundang sprang to his feet and challenged loudly, "Who comes?" And out of the darkness a dozen guards half-dragged and half-carried an old woman. She wore only a skirt of untanned hyena skin, and around her neck the grisly accoutrement and trappings of the witch's trade. Her eyes were rolled up into her head, so that the whites flashed in the firelight, and her spittle foamed on her slack lips. From her throat issued the wails of mourning for the dead. "What is it, witch?" Gundang demanded, his superstitious fears twisting his mouth and darkening his eyes. "What tidings do you bring?"
"The white men have desecrated the holy places. They have destroyed the chosen one of the spirits. They have slaughtered the priests of the nation. They have entered the cave of the Amlimo in the sacred hills, and her blood is splashed upon the ancient rocks. Woe unto all of us! Woe unto those who do not seek revenge! Kill the white men! Kill them all!"
The witch threw off the restraining hands of the guard, and with a wild shriek hurled herself into the midst of the leaping flames of the watchfire. Her skirt burst into flames. Her wild bush of hair burned like a torch. They drew back in horror.
"Kill the white men!"
screamed the witch from out of the flames. And they stared as her skin blackened and her flesh peeled from off her bones. She collapsed, and a torrent of sparks flew up into the overhanging branches of the forest. And then there was only the crackle and drum of the fire. Batso stood in the stunned silence, and he felt the rage rising from deep within his soul. Staring into the flames at the black and twisted remains of the witch, he felt the same need of sacrifice, an atonement and surcease from the rage and the grief. He saw in the yellow flames an image of Tanasi's beloved face, and something seemed to tear in his chest. "Gee," he said, drawing out the war cry, giving expression to his rage. "Gee!" He lifted the assegai and pointed the blade in the direction of the river and the white men's laager, which lay not more than a mile beyond the dark silhouette of the hills. "Gee!" And the night breeze turned the tears cold as the snow melt from the Drakensberg mountains upon his cheeks. "Gee!" Manonda took up the chant and stabbed towards the enemy, and the divine madness descended upon them. Gundang was the only one who had reason and fear of consequence left to him. "Wait," he cried, "wait, my children and my brothers." But they were gone already, racing away into the darkness to rouse their sleeping impis. Zuga Ballantyne could not sleep, though his back and thighs still ached for rest from hard riding, and the earth under his blanket was no harder than that on which he had passed a thousand other nights. He lay and listened to the snores and occasional dreamer's gabble from the men around him, while vague forebodings and dark thoughts kept him from joining in their slumber. Once again vivid memories of the little tragedy in the cave of the Amlimo returned to plague him, and he wondered how long it would be before the news of the atrocity reached the king and his indunas. It might take weeks for a witness to come down from the cave of the Matopos. But when that happened, he would know it by the actions of the Matabele and Dunas. From the opposite side of the laager, a skyrocket went hissing up into the night sky and popped into little red stars high in the heavens. The pickets had been firing a rocket every hour to guide a missing patrol into the laager. Now Zuga reached under the saddle, that was his pillow, and brought out the gold hunter watch. In the light of the skyrocket, he checked the time. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. He threw off his blanket and groped for his boots. While he pulled them on, his premonition of lurking evil grew stronger. He strapped on his bandolier and checked the Webley service revolver hanging on the webbing. Then he stepped over the sleeping, blanket-wrapped forms around him and went down to the horse lines. The bay gelding wickered as it recognized him, and Jan Sharut woke. "It's all right," Suga told him quietly. But the little Hottentot yawned, and with the blanket over his shoulders like a shawl, hobbled across to stir the ashes of his cooking fire. He set the blue enamel coffee pot on the coals, and while it was heating, they sat side by side and talked quietly like the old friends that they were.
"Less than 60 miles to Gubulawayo," Jan Sharut murmured. "It's taken us more than 30 years. But now at last I can feel we are coming home."
"I have bought up almost 40 land grants, Zuga agreed. "That is nearly 250,000 acres.
"Yes, Jan Sharut, we are coming home at last. By God, it's been a long, hard road, though, from the pit of Kimberley mine to the Zambezi."
Zuga broke off and listened. There had been a faint cry, almost like a night bird, from beyond the laager.
"The Mashona,"
Jan Sharut grunted. "The general should have let them stay in the laager." During the slow trek up from Iron Mine Hill, many small groups of Mashona had come to the wagons begging protection from the assembling Matabele. They knew from bitter experience what to expect when the Impis swept across the land in battle array. "The general could not take that chance," Zuga shook his head. "There may be Matabele spies among them. He has to guard against treachery." Mungo St. John had ordered the refugees to keep clear of the laager, and now there were 400 or 500, mostly black women and children, camped amongst the thorn trees on the river bank, 500 yards from the nearest wagon. Zuga lifted the coffee pot from the coals and poured the steaming black brew into his mug. Then he cocked his head again to listen. There was a faint hubbub, a distant chorus of shrieks and shouts from the direction of the river. With the mug in his hand, Zuga strolled across to the nearest wagon in the square and climbed up onto the Disselboom. He peered out of the laager towards the river. The open expanse of flat clay was ghostly pale in the starlight, and the tree line beyond it was solid blackness. There was nothing to be seen, except... He blinked his eyes rapidly, for they were playing him false. Nothing except the blackness of the tree line seemed to be closer. The blackness was spreading towards the laager across the pale clay, like spilled oil or a pool of blood. Now there was a sound, a rustle like locust wings, when the swarms pass overhead, and the engulfing blackness was coming closer with eerie swiftness. At that moment another skyrocket went whooshing up into the night sky, and when it burst it flooded the pan with a soft pink light, and Zuga dropped the mug of steaming coffee. The earth was black with the Matabele horde. It swept like a black tide towards the wagons, rank upon rank of great oval shields, and the assegais twinkled in the reflection of the rocket flare. Zuga pulled the pistol from its holster and fired towards the racing black wall of shields. "Stand to your guns!" he bellowed, the heavy revolver bouncing and crashing in his fist. "The Matabele are coming! Stand to your guns!" And from the black tide swelled a sound like a swarm of bees when the hive is overturned. The hammer of Zuga's revolver clicked on a spent cartridge, and he jumped down from the Düsselboom and raced down the line of wagons to where the nearest Maxim was emplaced. Throughout the laager there was a rush of bodies and the shouts of frightened men running to their posts, and as Zuga reached the corner of the square, the machine gunner came stumbling out from his bed under a wagon body. His face was a pale blob, and his hair was hanging into his eyes. He was in stocking feet, and his braces dangled down his legs as he hitched his breeches and plumped himself down on the little seat that was built onto the rear leg of the Maxim tripod. His number two loader was nowhere to be seen, perhaps lost in the milling confusion of newly awakened bodies. So Zuga stuffed the revolver into his belt and dropped upon his knees beside the ungainly weapon. He yanked the top off the ammunition box and lifted out the first length of the canvas belt. "Good o, mate," muttered the gunner, as Zuga lifted the shutter in the side of the breech and passed the brass tag loader of the belt through the block. "Ready? Load one," he snapped, and the gunner jerked back the crank handle on the opposite side of the block and let it fly home, and the jib at the top of the extractor gripped the first round.